from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, President Obama has called on the nation to do some soul-searching after the shooting death in Florida of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin. The incident has sparked protests across the nation, and we'll speak with local African-American men about the tragedy and their own experiences on Forum next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. 1 month ago today, on the 26th of February, a young 17-year-old African-American male named Trayvon Martin was shot and killed in an incident which has inspired marches of thousands throughout the nation and continues to have strong aftershocks. President Obama, who said if he had a son, the son would look like Trayvon Martin, proclaimed of this tragedy in Florida that it is, quote, a time for soul-searching for us all. And what sparked the national outcry and debate was the surge of social media and the fact that the young man who was killed was unarmed. And the man who shot him, a neighborhood watch person by the name of George Zimmerman, was released without charges under Florida's Stand Your Ground law, a law in 24 states, now being reconsidered in Florida by the legislator who wrote it, which allows for the use of deadly force if the one using it can reasonably assume he or she is faced with harm. The FBI, the Justice Department, and the United States Attorney's Office are presently all investigating this case, and the Florida District Attorney has called for a grand jury investigation. This morning's opening Forum Hour, we want to get response and personal thoughts from three local African-American men who really represent three distinct generations of African-American men. And I should mention also that tens of thousands of people are expected today to converge on Sanford for an afternoon rally to protest the killing of Trayvon Martin. Reverend Jesse Jackson, Baltimore Ravens linebacker Ray Lewis, the Reverend Al Sharpton, comedian Sinbad, all expected to speak at 5 p.m. special commission meeting. Joining us in studio for the hour, James Taylor, Associate Professor of Politics, University of San Francisco. James Taylor, good to have you here.
Welcome. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Jabari Gray is also with us. He's a development officer with Youth Radio, which has been among others at Youth Radio, has been gathering responses locally to this tragedy. And Jabari Gray, good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you. And with us by phone this morning is Miles Bess, who is also with Youth Radio in Oakland, a peer teacher with Youth Radio, also senior in high school in Alameda. Miles Bess, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you all for being here. And James Taylor, let's begin with you. When you first got word about this, it's my understanding, I mean, you saw the analogies, as many have, to the Emmett Till case, and you wrote directly to Bill Lee, who is the chief of police in Sanford.
Yeah, exactly. I did. I just sort of just reacted to all of the media coverage and felt like the way to sort of feel a sense of empowerment was to reach out, and I did. And he responded in kind, and I basically asked him to pursue justice in this case. And he wrote back an email and said that there was no prejudice involved and that they were doing the best they could, and they turned the case over to the state's attorney general in Florida. And that was our initial reaction. But I also told him in a subsequent email when I learned about the way they treated Trayvon Martin's body and the way they discarded it and sort of just let it sit, and the way they tested his body for drugs, et cetera, that this will be his downfall. I told him this will be your Emmett Till. And this is the allusion to the 1955 murderer of a boy in Chicago, from Chicago, who went down to Mississippi and allegedly whistled at a white woman, and he was murdered, and that galvanized the black community. And that was the real impetus for the civil rights movement, at least at that stage in 1955.
Of course, in the Emmett Till case, there was an arrest.
And that's right.
There is not an arrest yet of George Zimmerman, who says he acted in self-defense.
Yeah.
You have also brought to my attention the fact that Neil Bortz, a popular national talk show host who's based out of Atlanta, which is only really hundreds of miles from Sanford, Florida, had tell us about this broadcast that came to your attention.
It was from June 14th of 2011 that caused a little bit of a stir nationally for a moment. It's too long to read here, take up our time. But it basically calls for the identical scenario that led to the death of Trayvon Martin. And people need to go back and listen to Neil Bortz's broadcast that basically calls for the murder of more thugs in Atlanta, which is about 440 miles away from Orlando. And Neil Bortz, as you know, is very popular in that whole region. So I'm not blaming this on Neil Bortz, but I'm saying he called for this very kind of activity and this kind of attitude towards African Americans, that every young African American man that's dressed a certain way is a potential thug and therefore deserves to die, and their mothers deserve to cry. And these are the words that Neil Bortz used on national radio.
Well, I wanted to just read something from Teray, who did a piece in Time magazine called How to Stay Alive While Being Black in the Wake of the Fatal Shooting of Trayvon Martin, Some Advice for Young Black Boys. And since you have two sons, I'm curious to get your response specifically. He says, it's unlikely but possible, he's talking to young blacks here, young black African-American men, that you could get killed today or any day. I'm sorry, but that's the truth. Black maleness is a potentially fatal condition. I tell you that not to scare you, but because knowing that could save your life. There are people who will look at you and see a villain or a criminal or something fearsome. It's possible they may act on their prejudice and insecurity. Being black could turn an ordinary situation into a life or death moment, even if you're doing nothing wrong.
Absolutely. I mean, black men in America are dangerous and endangered. And this Trayvon Martin case brings to reality. I think the reason why it struck such a chord for so many people is that the arbitrariness of it and the randomness of it. It's enough for a young African-American man on a daily basis to have to deal with the fear of violence in general within the community, just walking down the street, being the victim of a drive-by. Then you have to worry about violence from police officers. And now this reality sort of says there's an added factor, and that's the sort of vigilantism that Neil Bortz is calling on, and that this young man, Zimmerman, executed down in Sanford in Florida.
Which is why you say this is a flashpoint for black America, a referendum for black people in the United States?
I think so, because just like the Jenna 6 case back in 2008, you know, it was a way of African-American people trying to address the issue of mass incarceration, the two-tier criminal system, the criminal justice system, the way it works differently for African-Americans who are poor and urban and male compared to other groups in society. So I think this is perhaps an opportunity for African-Americans to have two conversations. And one is about violence within the black community itself and how it is that we react with complete national movement. We've created a national movement in response to the killing of one young African-American boy by a non-African-American white Hispanic man. And at the same time, we sort of seem to accept the routinization of violence in our own communities. And we have to have both conversations about vigilantism, about police officers who don't abide by the law themselves, but also about the violence in our own communities.
You mentioned Zimmerman as a Hispanic man. Actually, his mother is Hispanic. His father, who is not, said because he's Hispanic, he can't be racist, mm-hmm. which seems kind of an odd thing to say.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking, by the way, with James Taylor, associate professor of politics at the University of San Francisco. Let's get your response to something else here, if I may, Professor Taylor. Kyle Rogers, who blogs at Examiner.com, also a national board member of the Council of Conservative Citizens, wrote a post for the Examiner asking questions about the facts that have been reported in mainstream media to this point. He says, quote, almost all news items are written solely from the point of view of the grieving family. The media also fills their articles with outdated babyface pictures of Trayvon. Very few include that he was a towering 6'2" football player. Is the media really reporting the news, or is this classic agitation propaganda to advance a political agenda?
It might be, but it's also true that in any kind of law across this country, when it comes to self-defense or no duty to retreat or, you know, these castle laws, it's about proportionality. It's, you know, you can't bring a gun to a fist fight. And Zimmerman brought a gun to a fist fight. No matter what the other circumstances are, that ends the conversation. All of the other details are to be adjudicated in a court of law. But at the end of the day, you know, there is no proportionality in that kind of reaction. Even if there was a mano-a-mano fisticuff fight, you don't end up with somebody being dead as a result of a bloody nose. And so the mere fact that the sheriff and the police chief and the you know, and suddenly these conservative people on Fox News and et cetera, everywhere else are starting to come out and criticize.
You're saying double standard. Newt Gingrich is saying they're making this into a racial incident and it shouldn't be.
Right. But the boy's language on the 911 tapes, when he refers to this young man as a effing, you know, C word, you know, the derivative of the N word, I have to use these substitutes, that racialized it. The moment he said he saw a young man who was black and that they always, he said these a-holes always get away with this stuff, and then he follows him and approaches him. If the same,
even after the 911 person said, leave it to us.
Yeah, and this is the same thing. If those roles were reversed, there's no way a young African-American boy can be would be allowed to, a 28-year-old black man shooting a 17-year-old white boy in those same exact circumstances. He would be in prison and he'd be facing the death penalty in the state of Florida right now.
James Taylor, Associate Professor of Politics, University of San Francisco. Jabari Gray is Development Officer with Youth Radio. And Jabari Gray, get a perspective from you on this. I mean, your reaction is to feel more paranoid, basically? I mean, could I put it so bluntly?
Feel more paranoid. I think, you know, it's really a situation where what we were describing earlier, the true circumstances of being a black man in America, paranoia is
sometimes possibly the mother of necessity. As
yes,
say.
Yeah. Exactly. Is a little bit a part of that experience. You know, any confrontation that you can get into in any given situation on any given day could go horrifically out of control. You know, one could easily be mistaken for, as I have been, a person that's up to criminal activity. And, you know, again, the kind of the temperament of the people involved as far as law enforcement or in this case, somebody who was doing the neighborhood watch could easily turn on its head. And I feel like a lot of that has to do with the racial dynamic. So
but tell us about your experience, because you actually had 8 guns pointed at you at one time in your life by police officers, sort of racially profiled, essentially.
Yes, that's true. You know, I was going, my father lives in Albany, California, which is a nice neighborhood. I was traveling from there to the Berkeley Hills to go on a date and going through the North Berkeley area, just north of the UC Berkeley campus, and was stopped unexpectedly. You know, I was tailed for a while, so I kind of knew that a stop was going to happen. You get used to these kinds of things. Mm-hmm. So, you know, kind of did my thing, was pulled over. Both ends of the street were immediately blocked. 6 cars came out, 8 officers with their guns drawn, pulled me out, you know, of the car, threw me on the street. It was pouring rain, dogs and cats. And, you know, essentially what happened was there was a witness standing in the dark, in the rain, a light shining on my face. I couldn't see them. The police assumed that I was driving with some other people in the vehicle. So they were looking for a car that had multiple passengers and a driver. I'm a solo driver, just happened to be in that neighborhood. And this person had to identify me in that moment, in the dark, in the rain. And what worried me the most was, I don't know if this person had a bad breakfast today or if they got into a fight with their spouse. Mm-hmm. I could easily be mistaken under these, even in these weather conditions, the dark, the heightened emotion, the rain coming down, mistaken for the person that they're looking for.
Yeah, it must have been terrifying. And of course, this is in Berkeley of all places.
Right,
you know, when you
right.
think about the irony of that. Right. You mentioned your father, and we should mention your father is white, and your father... Well, actually, we have a cut of your father talking that was done for Youth Radio about his concern, and I'd like our listeners to hear it.
You can hear him yell once for help, and then there's a shot. And that just triggered my reaction all over again, because he was obviously young and very afraid and in danger. So even though I knew you were here and safe and not in Florida or not someplace I didn't know, calling you was not really for your safety probably so much as to calm myself down just to hear your voice. I think that's the kind of thing that happens with many, many families where one of the children or more have been in danger. that kind of triggering stays within the parent, and you don't lose it.
He's a very loving father.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And concerned about his son, and like he said, triggered. I mean, you know, that's kind of the verb here for a lot of parents. This just triggered deep emotions. You know?
I had no idea that he would respond to the tragedy in this way, being that I am, you know, thousands of miles away from the incident.
But he remembers what you went through in that incident you just described to us, you know?
And I think that what happens when, for me personally, going through life, knowing that that kind of interaction is around the corner potentially, I mentioned that experience very casually, you know, with the incident with the police to my father much later. And that was because it was part of who I am. It's not the first time something – it's the first time it was that dramatic, but it's not the first time that kind of profiling has happened, that kind of interaction. So I mentioned it very casually, and for him, it was entirely emotional and charged with, you know, the sense of danger and potential fatality. But for me, it was kind of one of those things. Was it messed up? It was messed up. You know, it really was. I'd use a lot of different words if I could at mm-hmm. this moment. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's not unexpected. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not out of the realm of possibility. Mm-hmm. So when he heard that, I think it was a sense of helplessness and knowing that he can't always be there for me as a parent, and especially as a white adult male. It's something that makes our experiences completely different mm-hmm. in this country, even though we're of the same blood.
Mm-hmm. Again, Jabari Gray is development officer with Youth Radio, and Youth Radio has been gathering responses on the Trayvon Martin killing. Miles Best is with us as well. He's a peer teacher for Youth Radio, also senior in high school at Alameda, and although, Miles, you live in Oakland, you go to school in Alameda, and you're mainly with white teachers and white students there.
Well, white teachers, yes, but student-wise, it is actually kind of pretty diverse.
It is, yeah. And yet, when you're walking along the streets, and I don't know if you wear a hood or not, I mean, part of this whole episode has been linked to, I mean, Geraldo Rivera said some very stupid things about, you know, wearing hoods and whatnot, but do you feel targeted? Do you feel, particularly as a result of this, even more vulnerable?
Yeah, pretty much. Because, like, I have to deal with this on, like, a daily basis. Like it's been said, I walk home from school every day, walk home from work, like, three times a day. And it's like I'm constantly, like, perceived as something that I'm not. You know, I'm looked at as a villain 24/7. It's like on my way to school, it's like I see people. Because I walk through a residential neighborhood to get to my school, and it's like I see people walking their dog, and it's like they give me these side eyes as if I'm there to, like, steal their dog, or if I'm going to just do something just totally wrong. And it's just I'm just trying to get to school, or I'm trying to get home, or I'm trying to get to work. And it's like I constantly have to deal with this cloud over my head.
That's the paranoia on the other side, or the anxiety or concern on the other side. You actually feel it. You sense it, and you read it in people's faces.
Every day. Yeah. Since I was, like, 7.
And how do you deal with that?
Honestly, I've just gotten used to it, which is sad. I shouldn't have to, but honestly, I've just gotten used to it, dealing with it almost every day.
What about you? You mentioned that not many of the teachers are African American at the school you go to, and how does that affect just day-to-day life as in terms of being educated?
I feel as if they can't relate to a lot of the black students sometimes, because it's like they're used to, it's like they can relate to the white students because it's like they come from, like, similar backgrounds a lot of times, and it's like they can't deal with what African-American students go through. They're willing to, like, help, which I really commend them for. It's like they're there to help, and they're there to help you succeed. But ultimately, it's like they don't know. They have to, it's, they can't relate.
And so you feel isolated from your teachers to a great degree?
To a certain degree, yeah. It's like there's a certain connection that's missing between student and teacher on account of, like, our backgrounds. And it's sad that it has to be that way, but it's true.
And Miles Best with us, a peer teacher with Youth Radio, a senior in high school in Alameda. Let me open the phone lines and bring our listeners into this. And by the way, there are a number of questions that I'd like to put out to listeners. If you're African-American, how do you feel, first of all, about the shooting of Trayvon Martin? But also, What is your experience? Have you felt targeted or in danger because you're black, or have you felt it coming from the other side, the sense of being looked at as a villain and being made to feel as if somehow you're dangerous or you're going to burgle or something along those lines? And does this incident shock you, or does it feel like the America you know, which is maybe even a bigger and a more challenging question? But I'd like to put those out there and bring listeners into this conversation, and you can do that now by joining us toll-free, 866-733-6786. We do welcome your phone calls, and those lines are available to you whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Again, 866-733-6786. You can also email your responses. Forum@kqed.org is our email address. You can also go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment or go to our Facebook page. So a number of ways that you can join the conversation. President Obama, again, has called on the nation to do soul-searching after the shooting death in Florida, 17-year-old black teen Trayvon Martin, which happened exactly 1 month ago. And the incident has sparked protests across the nation, church groups meeting here in the Bay Area. We're talking to three local African-American men about the tragedy and about their own experiences. Miles Best, peer teacher with Youth Radio, Jabari Gray, a development officer with Youth Radio, and James Taylor, associate professor of politics at the University of San Francisco. And I guess the Black Caucus, Congressional Black Caucus, has called this a hate crime, James Taylor. Do we know enough to say that this
is a
hate crime?
Well, I think, CNN, you know, used their audio experts to let you hear the immediate 911 calls as he was on, as Zimmerman was on the phone with the police, with the dispatcher. And right before he tells him to back off, he uses this epithet. That makes it a crime of hate. And as a consequence, I think, you know, the federal government will find this conclusion. This is not an isolated incident. I mean, we're in that time right now. Here in California, down in San Diego, just yesterday, I think it was, we found a hijabi woman who they found bludgeoned and with a sign next to her body telling her to go back to her country of Iraq. You know, and so we have these incidents and they just seem to be isolated. But I think at some point you have to sort of bring the whole sum of them together and characterize this era as an era that is not sufficiently post-racial.
Well, the thing also about Zimmerman was he made 46 calls from January 7th. He seemed to be quite obsessed with what he described as black hoodlums and they're getting away with things. And yeah. This is a man who desperately wanted to be a police officer, didn't make it for whatever reason, so he joined his neighborhood watch. At this point, what makes it particularly difficult, though, is the Stand Your Ground law and the fact that, you know, we can't get any kind of testimony from Trayvon Martin.
Yeah, well, we started looking at the sourcing of these Stand Your Ground laws, you know, this whole entity called ALEC. This entity of the American, I think it's the American Legislative Exchange Council, which has all of these large corporations and like the NRA, the Corrections Corporation of America, Exxon, et cetera. And they've been writing these laws in all of these different states to sort of privatize everything. And so this is something that African-American leaders and organizations like the NAACP are going to have to do is challenge the NRA firsthand because too much killing is happening. Too many black boys and black men in America are dying. And it doesn't matter the race of the shooter. It just matters the race of the victim. And at some point, ordinary Americans have to begin to take responsibility, as the president says, and search their souls, because white people don't get shot 41 times in America unarmed like Amadou Diallo, or 51 times like Sean Bell in New York, or get shot like Oscar Grant on the BART plant. That just does not happen in America. It happens to black people on a regular basis. There was another case just last month in New York where the police shot a young man in his family's bathroom who was unarmed. And or like what happened here in Hurricane Katrina, where you had African-Americans trying to escape the hurricane and the police officers from New Orleans Police Department shoot them on Donziger Bridge. I mean, this just doesn't happen to any other group in this country. And it's high time we have a referendum on it.
I want to just read something again from Teray before we go to our break here and come back and hear your thoughts and take your calls. He says to young black men, it's your mission to survive. You could be a Trayvon. Any of us could. When we return, we'll hear from you on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. President Obama has called on the nation to do some soul-searching after the shooting death in Florida of 17-year-old black teen Trayvon Martin. The incident has sparked protests across the nation. We're talking with three local African-American men from different generations about the tragedy and about their own experiences. And I should mention that nearly three-quarters of Americans, including 67% of whites and 86% of non-whites, this is according to a recent CNN poll, believe police should arrest George Zimmerman, the Neighborhood Watch volunteer who acknowledged shooting Martin. And that's a CNN ORC international poll that was released just today. Some of our listeners are writing, Ellen says, even if we decided to believe George Zimmerman when he says he was acting in self-defense, that is still no justification for pulling a gun on an unarmed person and shooting him. Federal civil rights law prohibits police officers from using excessive force and carrying out their duties. Ordinary citizens should not be allowed to use excessive force to defend themselves. Another listener, Sonia, writes, if Zimmerman's last name were Gutierrez, the police would not have been so quick to release him. They might have even added a gang rivalry tag. Mm. Bill writes, I don't presume to know what happened that night, but I simply don't understand how a corpse at the scene of an incident isn't sufficient forensic evidence to warrant detention of the gunman, at least while the investigation is resolved. So you can hear a lot of this indignation and anger about Zimmerman being released free, which has, of course, been a rather strong galvanizing force behind a lot of the protests. Let me go to your calls, and we begin, William, with you. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. I was awarded a scholarship at Harvard University back in the early 90s when Harvard was doing a study on racism. And it was quite interesting that even in the psychology department, there were no minorities present in the class. And I was awarded a scholarship in order to take part in this study so that there could be a well-rounded view of what took place. Well, unfortunately, what occurred was that the student body there did not quite believe the black experience. So we actually went out and did experiments where whites and blacks boarded elevators at the same time, and we watched white women change their purses from one side of their body to the other. We actually went into department stores, and we had whites and blacks enter the department stores to see that the security guards actually trailed the black person, but did not trail the white person when they were shopping for the same items. We also studied the fact that black people were being charged more in the economy than whites for monetary goods. It was a quite interesting study. Then my own personal experience, which ranges for close to 70 years here in the United States, has been somewhat sad. The profiling that takes place still continues. I've been a resident of Marin County for the last 20 years, and when first arriving here, even though studying and working with some phenomenal figures in the psychology field, I was stopped by almost every community in Marin and profiled, questioned. Even one morning, I was forced to get out of my car and stand in the middle of downtown San Anselmo while my entire car was being searched, and I was accused of being a burglar and chasing the neighborhood when, in fact, I lived in that neighborhood and was freely walking in the streets like everyone else to get some air in the evenings. But that seemed to bother the residential body. I find it very sad.
Yeah, it is sad. I was just going to say these are very telling and sad stories. And your discussion about the Harvard experiment with the women clutching their purses reminds me of young Jabari Gray, who you've seen a lot of that, I guess, you know, women holding their purses when you walk down the street.
Oh, well, at this point, it's almost amusing to watch. You know, it's something that if there's just myself and, you know, a Caucasian woman approaching from the opposite direction, sometimes I'll sort of ask myself, well, how many seconds will it take for her to cross the street? Or, you know, what will she do when we start to pass one another? Will she wide step or will she shift her purse? So I'm very aware of that. It happens a lot. And now I just take the liberty to cross the street first.
Mm-hmm. And Miles Best, this is something you have observed and experienced as well.
A lot. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Clenching purses, crossing the street, like Mr. Gray said. It's pretty much just all of that.
Well, James Taylor, you're the elder statesman here.
Right. Well,
I mean, is it more young men, do you think?
No, because even William Julius Wilson, speaking of Harvard, who is a prominent sociologist at Harvard University, in his most recent book, It's Not Just Race, explains his own experiences and his own upscale.
As long as we're talking about Harvard, we mentioned Skip Gates, Henry Louis Gates.
Yeah, exactly. And so William Julius Wilson talked about his own experiences on elevators, and this is the man in his 70s, and now he has to sort of, if he's dressed a certain way, he has to sort of release the fear of whites of him, and he's he's a 70-year-old man, and imagine someone as young as Jabari, that there's a daily obsession with black fear of black men, and the claim is that it's about black criminality. So someone like Abigail and Stephen Thernstrom, the scholars who work for the Enterprise Institute, for example, or Heritage Foundation rather, they will shoot back that this is about black crime, and if blacks want to integrate fully into America, it's about crime. But when you look at the 1990s, violent crime amongst blacks went down every single year throughout that decade, but the black incarceration rates increased exponentially for using drugs that whites were using more. And yet African Americans went to jail more for an offense that they commit less. So it's not just about black criminality.
Well, it's the old argument, about blacks being predominantly on welfare, which has been mythologized for years. But what do you say about, because you're hearing this particularly from some conservative sources, there were 8 burglaries by black men in just a year in this particular apartment complex where George Zimmerman was. So I'm using a phrase now that I heard repeatedly, the stage was set.
Yeah, that might be the case, but there's no evidence at all, zero, that Trayvon Martin was involved in any kind of criminal activity, independent of everyone else who may have been. He was not. And so we're not talking about everyone else. We're talking about Trayvon. And Trayvon, there's no evidence that he committed a crime.
Yeah, he was a kid with Skittles and an iced tea. He was just going to, well.
And that's the difference here. Let me give you 1 second. That's the difference here is those like the conservatives, they would love for Trayvon to have some scandal, some criminal record or some scandal. Every day they keep dripping out more information about him. Like now he was the aggressor. Yesterday was about him being suspended from school. Before it's all over, they will completely criminalize Trayvon Martin. That's what will happen because he was one of the innocent ones. He was not a thug. He was not a criminal. And if he had a police record like one out of every 4 young black men did, then they could say, well, Zimmerman was in his right. This guy was a criminal, and he defended himself against a criminal. They killed an innocent boy this time.
Well, that's what happened with the case of a guy from Seattle, wasn't it, who was down here in the Hunters Point area?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. They found out the dirt on him. That's right. The community had a legitimate righteous indignation until they found out that this guy had a criminal record up in Seattle. Then the community had to be silent. But this time with Trayvon, they killed an innocent one.
Let me bring another caller in from Pittsburgh. Richard, hi. You're on.
Hi, good morning. Well, I'd like to say that it gets better, but it doesn't. I put up with this stuff when I was a teenager. So you think by the time you get to be 57 years old, you could tell the difference between a wild and potentially crazy teenager and a basically about to become old man. But nope, same fear, same craziness. It doesn't get better.
Does this make you, Jabari Gray, feel pretty pessimistic when you hear people even much older than yourself saying it doesn't get any better, somebody 70 years old saying I was stopped still, that sort of thing?
Well, you used the phrase earlier, maybe this is the America that I know, and it is. It doesn't necessarily make me pessimistic, I think, from this point on. I was recently put out of a cab for a suspicion of not having money. That tore me apart, the violent part, I think, for me remains to be expected. There is always, the potential for an explosive interaction sort of just out there in the public. But it's the little things like being suspected of just trying to swindle someone on a taxi ride, or those are the things that really where you think, okay, at least we're past that, but we're not. And whether or not it makes you pessimistic, it's sad. It's deeply saddening is really what it is. And it's disappointing to realize that maybe I'm just a realist.
Yeah.
You know, like this is really what we're working with. And it has
a real impact on black men's health. I mean, these stress-related health conditions like hypertension, diabetes, many of these conditions come, I mean, they are racially based, and most people don't want to acknowledge that, but African-American men have the shortest lifespan out of any group in America. And that is largely associated with the stress of being black in America on a daily basis.
Well, let me thank the caller. I'm going to go to more calls in a moment, but I want to go to some emails here from really some different perspectives. Here's a listener who writes, "What makes me angry is that the only time I see a majority of black people get angry about a black person being killed is when a white person or a cop is responsible, which in comparison to black-on-black killings is rare." Another listener, David, writes, "Trevon's shooting seems obviously wrong, and hopefully the legal system will bring justice. Working in the Bayview every day, I see black youth intentionally dressing in the style of thugs. Given the prejudices they face, it seems especially important not to dress in a way that supports the stereotype. I'd like your guest feedback on black youth's dress, pants falling off, giant hoodies, etc., reinforcing negative stereotypes." Miles Best, can we go to you on this?
Sure. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter at all. It doesn't matter when I'm walking down the street in slacks, dress shoes, or a button-up. I'm getting persecuted every day. But I can see where they're coming from.
Wait, honestly. Persecuted or looked at suspiciously?
Looked at suspiciously. Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm going on something different. But I do see where they're coming from sometimes, because there are kids that I do see that do feed into the stereotype that have nothing to do with the thug life at all. It's just like they come. It's like I see where they live, and it's like they have these two-story houses. They have two parents. They're well-rounded. They're, you know, saying they're really diverse. Yet, for some reason, they're wearing these baggy pants and these big hoodies, and like they're walking around like they're trying to be up to no good. When knowing darn well, they're just like going to school, trying to get educated like everyone else. And it's like they don't understand. So I do see where that person is coming from.
And what do you think, Jabari, about the listener who writes about what about black on black crime?
I mean, black-on-black crime is a tragedy. It's a terrible reality, and the fact that it has existed to detrimental levels for such a long time is incredibly saddening. Comparing that to the interaction between the black population and the authorities, I dare say that it's...
I don't know if Jared Zimmerman was an authority, though. He was kind of a self-appointed authority. Yeah.
People trying to enforce laws and boundaries, let's say. I think that they're very different things. I mean, violence comes in all different kinds of ways. And, black-on-black crime is horrible and terrible.
I think the listener was saying there's not enough outcry about that compared to, let's say, something like, what happened in Florida
or in
the BART station.
And I absolutely agree. I think that there are certain things that are part of our history here in this country that maybe were more in the forefront, more hot button topics at certain times, certain different decades. And over time, the lens or the light is shining in a different direction. And I agree. I think the wrongs that we do ourselves mm-hmm. are much more tragic than the wrongs that are done to us by other people. Whatever the catalyst is to bring about a unifying voice, it doesn't really make a difference to me at this point. It's the coming together mm-hmm. and having these several conversations, like the professor was saying. There are several conversations in the racial dynamic mm-hmm. of the African American experience, and they all need to be talked about.
Well, here's another one. Maybe get a response from you, Professor Taylor, or on our website. Listener writes, "The killing of Trayvon was a complete tragedy. The truth will come out. However, I'm a white person who's lived in Atlanta and Oakland who's seen daily crimes where whites and blacks have been victimized by young black males. The sad truth is that the genuine thugs committing crimes every single day have made whites defensive, cautious, and very angry at being constant victims living in fear. Good law-abiding black folks need to put themselves in our shoes, too."
Right. And that's just the thing. Whoever this person is displays a profound ignorance of the fact that it is blacks who are the primary victims of violence by other black people. And so the fear of being victimized is one thing. And that is not only something that African-Americans sort of generate, corporate America loves for Americans to be afraid because it drives profit. But African Americans are the ones that are the primary victims of other African American criminal activity. And that's the tragedy of America, is that we are ready to identify black people as perpetrators of crime, but we're not willing to acknowledge black people as victims of crime. And so this question that was just submitted to you displays a profound lack of knowledge about the daily experience of ordinary black people. And I think this is why this conversation we're having is important.
Another listener writes, just for balance, in 1960 in Albany, New York, contrast with Albany, California, a friend and I were hitchhiking home when five police cars surrounded us, pulled guns, told us to drop it. We were holding a bag with food, not racial. We were white, normally dressed, just paranoid, fear of the young. Don't get me wrong. What happened in Florida was racist and the result of a terrible law. But that was submitted for balance, and we'll go to another caller here. Matthew, join us. You're on the air.
Hi, yes. I'm a white male, and one of my best friends happens to be black. He's a little bit older than I am, so not a big deal. But when we go out and hang out and do different things, we've gone out to have dinner together, and I go up to pay, and, you know, the person says, oh, thank you for feeding a homeless person. Just really sort of sad and embarrassing things. We've been out to Art and Soul Festival or somewhere like that, and my wife and my daughter and I were hanging out with my friend, and a woman actually called the security guard over to see if we were being bothered by this man. Just, you know, quite a few sort of incidents have happened over the last couple years, actually, and, you know, this is in the Bay Area, in Berkeley, Oakland, places that are fairly progressive, that makes it pretty sad that some of these things have happened. He hasn't even noticed it, and I wouldn't even want to tell him sometimes because I feel like it's just such a sort of slap in the face to just our friendship and just anything. Pretty embarrassing.
But so, this is just from hanging out with him. I mean, you've noticed this, yeah?
Oh, yeah, just going to, we've gone to restaurants, we've done things, and there's always this sort of, it's strange for he and I to even be next to each other. You know, I mean, I don't know if it's definitely a racist thing, but it's also maybe an ageist thing too. But it's, and this is coming from the woman that actually had the security guard come over to check on us. She happened to be black herself. She, you know, and then she apologized after, oh, I'm sorry, I thought he was harassing you. But I mean, we're literally just sitting down talking, and it just seems so strange and out of the, it doesn't make sense for us to be friends that people seem to have an issue with it. And like I said, they either think he's homeless or, you know, or he's harassing us or something like that. And these are just, this happens quite often.
Well, Matthew, thank you for that. I want to ask Miles Best, does this dovetail with your experience, Miles? Does this sound familiar to you?
Yeah, most definitely. It's like I've noticed that when I go to restaurants sometimes and I want to go to the bathroom, I've been told to pay before I use the bathroom, or I actually get followed to the restroom, and like I have like a time limit on how much time I can use the bathroom because they think like I'm rolling up weed or like I'm loading a weapon or something like that. So I've definitely seen things like that happen before and like it's happened to me too.
Nathan, you're on with us, Nathan. Good morning.
Hi.
Hi.
Nathan. I'd just like the gentleman to address. I grew up Jewish, and part of our history is the shtetls, where the Jews lived apart from the Gentiles, and that did not work out well for us. And I've noticed just through my own black friends, through just everybody else, that black folk tend to live apart from white folk or don't mix much in company. There's not much going back and forth between the houses. I brought my buddy Cornell over to my house. He's like, I've never been in a white person's house before. And then I went over to his house, and it hit me. I've never been in a black person's house before. And it's just, what with the fear of the other and whatnot, what can be done, you know, to get people more acquainted with each other and so less afraid? I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Some thoughts from you, James Taylor?
I mean, Martin Luther King talked about the idea of the beloved community, and I think he said you can't legislate love, so you can't force an unnatural reality. But it is true that for 400 years in this country, people have been taught racial hate. And it's going to take the same kind of concerted effort to teach racial love and acceptance as we go forth into the 21st century, because this country is browning. This country is becoming much more diverse. And so we have to deal with this now while we still can at the early stage of the century, because as W.E.B. Du Bois said, the color line was the problem of the 20th century. Diversity of America, it's browning. The Asian population will double. The Latino population grows exponentially. The African-American population is growing, and the American white population is in decline. And that combination of demographic changes requires that we reset the racial contract of America as we move forward.
As long as we're talking for a moment about W.E.B. Du Bois, he also said something about what he called dual consciousness.
Yeah, the double and consciousness.
I want to actually get Jabari and Miles' response to that. He said, you know, when you're black in America, and this is, you know, going back many, many years ago, of course, Souls of Black Folks was published around the turn of the century. Yeah. He said, when you're black in America, you are constantly aware of being judged in terms of what you are as opposed to who you are. In other words, you have your individual identity. You're Jabari Gray. But you are always mindful of the fact that people are judging you on your skin.
Sure. I mean, I go to work every day. I wear suits. I drive a European sedan. Some of that stuff I do because of how I need people to perceive me. A lot of that is, you know, not wanting to come across in a certain way, and say, hey, I'm doing everything that everybody, quote unquote, normal is doing. I'm trying to get ahead. I'm just trying to represent myself well in a professional manner.
But it may not matter, I guess, is the point I keep hearing from these representatives of three generations. There was a black admiral in a uniform. I remember driving, I think, a really beautiful sports car, which may have had something to do with it. But he was stopped, and he was, of course, questioned, and he was in the wrong neighborhood at the time.
All one can try to do, in my opinion, is reduce the potential for something unwieldy to happen. Mm. But being put out of a cab, I was in my dress clothes. Mm. It really comes down to, I think, you know, the professor called out 400 years of slavery and horrific activity. It would have to take at least that, if not twice as long, I think, to undo what has now become part of the DNA of this country. And whatever we can do as black males to sort of not represent ourselves in a stereotypical fashion. And I think even calling hoodies and baggy jeans thug apparel is already, we're talking in terms of prejudices.
Yeah.
It's just the clothing selection. Yeah. But we assign that to a specific group of people the same way we try to assign suits and European sedans to another group of people. But in the end, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I'm old enough to remember when we used to wear our hair long and bell-bottom pants. And
right.
You know, we were judged as being hippies. Actually, before I go to another caller, Miles Best, I want to get you on record here about this whole idea of feeling judged by what you are as opposed to who you are.
Oh, yeah. It's like I try to indirectly educate sometimes. It's like when I'm walking to school and, like I said, like the woman kind of looks at me suspiciously or something like that, I'll make sure I say, oh, hey, how you doing? Or, you know, saying, excuse me. And it's like I try to articulate myself, and it's like I try to present myself in a positive manner, and I always have a smile on my face. And that, like, kind of, I can see it having an effect on these people.
You defuse them, huh?
Yeah, basically. It's like I see it having an effect. Like when I'm walking and I do such things, they'll like, oh, okay. And it's like they're kind of taken aback at that. Or, you know, saying I'll give up my seat on the bus or something like that. It's like I try to just be positive as possible.
Well, let me bring a caller on. And Bob is joining us from Mountain View. Bob, hi, you're on.
Hi, just before I say this, I want to say the panelists know what I'm saying here. And they know that there's black crime and there's black on black crime. And that's why they put up with a lot of the stuff they have to put up with. And this is what's going on. And they're putting that in context. But I just have to put the other half of the story out about, you know, before we pin the whole black experience on Mr. George Zimmerman, the person involved here. I've heard snippets of the other half of the story, but not the whole thing. The young-faced man picture from junior high school that you see on TV is no longer was not the case here. This young man is no longer a little boy. He's 6'2". He's 17 years old. And there is a story, naturally, from Fox News has picked this up, from a man named John, which has been reported to the police, which is why they didn't arrest Mr. Zimmerman. And he saw exactly what happened and verified the entire block captain story. And this is what he said. The screams that were heard on the tape from this lady who was also calling 911, who only you heard the turd scream, heard background noise, was not from the young man, the 6'2" young man. The screams, according to this man who saw the whole thing, was from Mr. Zimmerman, and who was on the ground. And he was being beaten so badly that he was screaming for his life, and those are the screams, the chilling screams that you hear. And and this is so bad that this man said, stop that right now, or I'm calling 911. And by the time he went upstairs and he saw this, he heard a shot. And then he went and he looked, and the young man, and the 6'2" young man was on the ground, and the shouting stopped. But that's the rest of the story. And like I want to say, I want to put this in context, And I want to say to young men and all African Americans know that this is the kind of thing. But this is the deal. This complex this Mr. Zimmerman was patrolling, it was filled with African Americans also, homeowners also. Just like the panelists are living in apartments and homes also that can have African Americans committing crimes. And the racial epithet that he said was said so lightly, it's unsure that he said it. It was garbled. And if he said it in such an unsure, garbled fashion, he was going into an area pursuing someone, and he might have had to have a little bit of courage, just unsure as to what's going on. If he did said it and had to have the highest technology, it was said not under his breath. It was not said, I'm going after effing coons. Nothing like that.
Let me jump in here because I've actually heard the tape, and it's difficult to make out. I must confess to you that he's saying what apparently has pretty much been described here. But this alleged eyewitness is backing a 28-year-old gunman. He's a person named John, and he told a Fox affiliate in Orlando that he saw an altercation unfold and saw the guy on the bottom with a red sweater yelling, help, help, who was Zimmerman. Now, this is all we have at this point, but this has been released by the press.
What's interesting is before, in the first police report, there was no blood, no bloody nose, no grass on the back of Zimmerman's body, none of this. But in the second police report, suddenly he has a bloody nose and he has grass on the back of his head. So why wasn't this mentioned in the original police report is, I guess, what we've exposed later. But there's a lot that needs to be answered, and, Fox News is not credible in any way, and so if they found a good witness, good for them. But there were other witnesses, women that were in earshot of the incident, and they said it was the teenager that they heard screaming and crying, and that all of a sudden it stopped once he was shot. So if it was Zimmerman who was doing all of the screaming, when he pulls the trigger, why doesn't he continue to scream? Why does everything stop when the trigger is pulled?
It's also important. You mentioned, that often in these cases they'll dig up a record and all that sort of thing. They talk to a lot of Trayvon's friends. I mean, the news people have been all over this. Mm-hmm. Almost to an individual, they said this was a nonviolent young man. Yeah. Never could imagine him even getting into a fight.
Yeah.
We'll have to leave it there. Let me extend thanks to all of our guests, to James Taylor, Associate Professor of Politics, University of San Francisco, Jabari Gray, Development Officer with Youth Radio, and Miles Bess, who is a peer teacher with Youth Radio and a senior in high school in Alameda. Thank you all for being with us on Forum. And thank you, our listeners. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. Want to extend thanks to Senior Editor Dan Zoll and to our producers, Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, and Tina Lauerberg. Also remind you that Youth Radio and their work gathering stories is something that we feel allied with and want to send out our props to. Thank you for being here. Another hour of Forum up ahead. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, who believe all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.